Buttons upon a metal platter and make percussive music. You want more? Descriptions? Yes. Empty threats? No. From a side room comes a steady herd of bedraggled humans. Their arms are bound, their mouths stopped with wax and linen. The great spirits herd them like goats toward a precipice. One by one, in the centre of the hall, their mouths are freed, and they stand before Lord Nauder's chair. He gives them an ultimatum. These humans, Mandrake said. Describe them. The baby sniffed. Tricky. Could you individuate a tribe of rabbits? It considered. Several lacked chins, while others boasted several. Kitty and Mandrake exchanged a glance. It is the government. Nauder gives each a choice. Following a certain formula, they must summon a spirit into themselves. The Jinni Fakwal stands by Nauder's chair, holding a weighty tome. He gives them the name to call. If they agree, the procedure is carried out. If not, they are to be destroyed. Mandrake bit his lip. What is the general consensus? So far, each politician has agreed to surrender his or her mind. They prefer to accept the vilest humiliation rather than a more honourable way out. Kitty kicked out at the wall. Nauder isn't wasting time. He's creating his army. And by doing so, removing the only people capable of resisting him, Mandrake said. Imp, what is the situation elsewhere? The baby shrugged. It depends on your point of view. From my perspective, the outlook is rosy. Few humans remain alive within this building. Beyond, in central London, great gatherings of commoners assemble, emboldened by the lack of response from the government. In Whitehall, two battalions of werewolves maintain ragged defence of the Parliament zone. A few magicians try frantically to communicate with their leaders, but to no avail. Ha! Some magicians are still in action, Mandrake nodded eagerly. The lower orders did not attend the play. Perhaps they can aid us. What demons do they use? A hodgepodge of foliates that cower behind the dustbins as the commoners march by. Mandrake groaned. Hopeless. Imp, your news is poor, but you have done well. He made a magnanimous gesture. If I survive, you shall have your freedom. That's me here for all eternity, then. The disc went blank. So, there will be no outside help, the magician said slowly. It will have to be the staff, if I can reach it. If I can get it to work. Kitty touched his arm. You were telling me about Ptolemy's Gate. What's the exact method? Can it be easily done? He tore himself away, eyes angry and bewildered. Why do you persist in this? Ptolemy used the gate to reach out to the djinn. It was a gesture of reconciliation, of good faith. We need to do this, and fast, if we're to get some help. Get some? Oh, dear. Mandrake spoke as if to a simple child. Kitty, the demons are our enemies. They have been for millennia. True, their powers are useful, but they are wicked things and will hurt us if they can, as proved this very night. Given half a chance, they are invading. Some are invading, Kitty said, but not all. Bartimaeus did not agree to stay. So what? Bartimaeus is nothing. Nothing but a middling jinni, frayed to a thread, whom I kept here too long. Even so, he has loyalty to us. Certainly to me. Maybe even you. The magician shook his head. Rubbish. His loyalty changes with every summoning. Just days ago he served another master, doubtless one of my rivals. But this is beside the point. To get the staff, I summoned him. I will need to get away. You must cause a distract. Hold on. What? I summoned him. Mandrake's eyes seemed to glaze. He swayed where he stood. His mouth made odd popping noises like a stranded fish. But you're a... Yes, Kitty cried. I'm a commoner. Well done. But that doesn't mean much any more, does it? Look around you. Everything's turning upside down. Magicians have destroyed the government. Demons are willingly being summoned by their own kind. Commoners are taking control of the streets. The old certainties are falling apart, Mandrake, and only those who adapt are going to prevail. I intend to. What about you? She indicated the door. Any moment now, Fakwal's going to walk back in and lead you before Nauder. Do you want to keep quibbling until then? Yes, I learned a little of your art. I summoned Bartimaeus. I wanted an alliance with him, but he rejected it because I couldn't trust him. He's sceptical about us, you see. Only one person in his past has treated him with absolute trust, and that was Ptolemaeus. Mandrake's eyes bulged.
What?
Not the same Ptolemy that... The very same! He used the gate, he made the gesture. Why do you think Bartimaeus still wears his form?
Oh, you hadn't realized? All those years of training, and you can't see what's right in front of your eyes?
She shook her head sadly. When I summoned him, she went on, Bartimaeus told me that he would have done anything for Ptolemy because of the gesture he made. There was no limit to our bond. That's how he put it. And you heard what he said just now, when he left.
A dozen emotions had washed across the magician's face, leaving it smooth, blank, chastened. He shook his head.
I didn't hear.
He said he had a bond with us, too, but that there were limits to it. That's what he told Nauda, and he was looking at me as he went. Don't you see? If I can follow him...
She was gazing beyond Mandrake now, eyes sparkling.
I know that I need to call Bartimaeus's name as part of the incantation, but beyond that I haven't a clue, until you tell me what's in the book.
She smiled at him. The magician took a slow, deep breath. Then he opened the book and skimmed to a certain page. For a moment he read in silence. When he spoke, his voice was flat. The procedure is simplicity itself. The magician reclines in a pentacle. He must sit or lie, since his body will collapse at the moment of transfer. No candles or specific runes are required. Indeed, such barriers are kept to a minimum to speed the return of the magician to his body. Ptolemy suggests breaking the circle symbolically to help this process. He also recommends holding something iron, such as an ankh, to keep out evil influences. That or one of the normal herbs, rosemary or such like.
Okay.
Well, the magician closes his eyes and shuts his mind to all outside stimuli. Then he inverts the basic summoning. His own true name is substituted for the demon's one, and all directions are reversed, to go instead of to come, and so forth. Finally, the name of a benevolent demon, Ptolemy calls it the sponsor, is called three times. The attention of this demon is necessary for an opening to be made. If all goes well, the magician separates from himself, the gate opens, and he passes through. Ptolemy does not give details of how or where. He looked up.
Satisfied?
Kitty sniffed. I like your assumption that the magician must be male.
Look, I've told you the method. Listen, Kitty.
Mandrake cleared his throat.
I'm impressed with your initiative and bravery, really I am, but this is just impossible. Why do you suppose no one has followed in Ptolemy's footsteps? The other place is alien and terrible, a region removed from normal physical laws. It would harm you, maybe kill you. And Bartimaeus, even if you survived, even if you found him, even if he agreed to somehow help you, is just a jinni. His power is negligible compared to Nauda's. Your idea is noble, but the chances of success are absolutely minute.
He coughed and looked away.
Sorry. That's all right,
Kitty considered.
Your plan, the staff. What are the chances of success there, would you say?
Oh, I'd say they were...
He caught her eye, hesitated.
Absolutely minute.
She grinned.
Exactly. And we probably won't get away from Nauda in the first place. But if we do, we both do what we can.
He smiled at her then, for the first time.
Well, if you do try, I wish you luck. Good luck to you too, Mr. Mandrake.
A rattle of a key, a metal screeching, the bolt beyond the door being drawn.
You don't need to call me that, he said. It's your name.
No, my name is Nathaniel.
Without ceremony, the door was flung aside. Kitty and the magician stepped back. A figure stepped through, black-coated, implacable. The mercenary gave a flinty smile. "Your turn," he said. Chapter 26. Nathaniel. Curiously, Nathaniel's immediate sensation was one of relief. The mercenary, at least, was human. He spoke quickly.
"You are alone?"
The bearded man stood in the doorway and regarded him steadily with his pale blue eyes. He did not reply. Nathaniel took this as a yes.
"Good," he said. "Then we have a chance. We must forget our differences and escape together."
The mercenary remained silent.
Nathaniel ploughed on. The demons are still slow and awkward. We will be able to slip out and organize defenses. I am a notable magician. Somewhere near here, other ministers lie bound. If we can release them, we will be able to fight the invaders. Your, skills will be invaluable in the battles to come. Past murders and other atrocities will be discounted, I'm sure. There may even be a reward for your service. Come, sir, what do you say?
The mercenary gave a little smile. Nathaniel beamed back. Lord Nowder, the mercenary said, is waiting for you. We would do well not to be late.
He stepped into the room. Grasping Nathaniel and Kitty by the arms, he led them to the door. Are you mad? Kitty cried. The demons threaten us all, and you willingly serve them?
At the doorway, the mercenary paused. Not willingly, he said in his deep, soft voice. But I must be realistic. The demons' power waxes every moment. Before dawn, all London will be in flames, and those who oppose them will be dead. I wish to survive.
Nathaniel squirmed in the iron grip. The odds are against us, but we can prevail. Reconsider before it is too late.
The bearded face bent close. The teeth were bared. You have not seen what I have seen. Quentin Makepeace's body sits on the golden chair, hands clasped upon the plumpness of his belly. His face is smiling, smiling. One by one the magicians of your precious government are brought before him. Some he allows to pass. They go to the pentacle to receive a demon. To others he takes a liking. He beckons them. They approach his chair, helpless as rabbits. He leans forward. The mercenary's jaw closed with a snap. Kitty and Nathaniel flinched. Afterward, he wipes his waistcoat and sits back smiling, and the demons around him howl like wolves. Nathaniel swallowed.
Not pleasant. Even so, with those boots of yours, surely you could—
I see all seven planes, the mercenary said. I see the power in that room. It would be suicidal to resist it. Besides, with power comes profit. The demons require human helpers. There is much here they do not understand. They have offered me wealth if I serve them. And this girl has that option, too. Who knows, by cooperating with Lord Nowder, she and I may flourish. He reached out his gloved hand and touched Kitty's neck. She recoiled from him with an oath. Blind anger surged inside Nathaniel, but he fought it down. The mercenary spoke no more. Gloved hands grasped their collars. Firmly, but without undue roughness, they were guided out of the door and up the corridor. In the distance they heard a great gabbling and babbling, a cacophony of shrieks and yells, the gathering sound of pandemonium. Nathaniel was quite calm. So black was the outlook now that fear had become redundant. The worst was upon them. Death was all but inevitable. Yet he faced it without anxiety. His final conversation with Kitty had lit a fire within him. To Nathaniel it seemed she had burned away all his weaker emotions. His head still spun with her revelations of Bartimaeus's past, but it was her own example that inspired him as the crisis approached. It scarcely mattered that she had pinned her hopes on Ptolemy's Gate, a mirage, a phantom, a fairy tale that all sensible magicians had long ignored. It was the look in her eyes as she talked of it that fascinated him. Excitement had shone there, and wonder, and belief. Sensations that Nathaniel had almost forgotten. Now, at the last, she had reminded him, and he was grateful. He felt cleansed, almost eager for what was to come. He glanced across. Her face was pale, but set. He hoped he would not weaken in front of her. His eyes flickered from side to side as they went, taking in the familiar surroundings of the Whitehall passages, the oil paintings, the plaster busts sitting in their niches, the panelled walls and impolite. They passed the stairs that led to the vaults, and, distantly, the staff. Instinctively, Nathaniel flinched toward it. The grip on his collar tightened. They rounded the final corner. Here, a mercenary whispered, let this sight put an end to your dreams. During their absence, the demons had been busy. The Hall of Statues, For 100 years the sedate meeting place of the council had been transformed by its new rulers. Everywhere was movement, noise, uncoordinated hubbub. Nathaniel's senses were briefly overwhelmed. The round table and its chairs had been swept from the centre of the room. The table now rested against the far wall. Upon it sat the golden chair. Here lolled Nauda, the great demon, in an attitude of temporary repletion. One leg dangled over a chair arm, the other extended before him. Makepeace's shirt had been untucked. It hung loose about the swollen stomach. The eyes were glazed, the mouth unnaturally stretched. It wore a tired smile, as of one who has lately completed a pleasant meal. A few odd rags and clothes lay on the tabletop around him. Below the table, upon a redwood chair, the demon Fakwal stood cloaked in Mr. Hopkins's body. It was he who orchestrated events. He held a book open in his hands and uttered crisp orders to the company below. The bodies of the 5 original conspirators, Nathaniel recognized Lyme, Jenkins, and the scrawny Withers, were now operated by their demons with some efficiency. True, there were still plenty of trips and stumbles, the legs and arms swinging with abrupt staccato movements, but they no longer fell or collided with the wall. This had enabled them to venture out of the room, and, as the scrying glass imp had reported, bring forth selected members of the government from their cells. Batch by batch, great and small, the magicians were being transformed. To the left, Lyme and Withers stood watchful guard over a huddle of waiting prisoners, perhaps 20 in number, their hands still bound. Not far away, in a pentacle close to Nauda's throne, one of these prisoners had been untied. Now she stood free, uttering the fatal summons in a quavering voice. She was a woman unknown to Nathaniel, presumably from another department. As he watched, she stiffened and shook. The air about her shimmered as the arriving demon took possession. Fakwal made a gesture. The demon Narian, dressed in Jenkins' body, led her gently to the far corner of the hall, to join... The hairs prickled on Nathaniel's head. There they were. More than 2 dozen magicians from every level of the government, rolling, twitching, laughing, falling as their masters explored their limitations. Occasional bursts of magical energy exploded against the walls. The air was full of the murmuring of alien tongues, strange cries of joy and pain. And what was that among them? Head twitching, hands rising and falling like a puppet's, florid face gleaming and vacuous. Nathaniel recoiled. Rupert Devereux, the Prime Minister. Despite everything that had occurred, despite his awakening abhorrence of what the man had been and represented, Nathaniel felt tears pricking at his eyes. For an instant he was 12 years old again, caught up in the swirl of Westminster Hall, seeing Devereux for the first time, dazzling, charming, everything he aspired to be. Devereux's body gave a caper, collided with another, and collapsed in a writhing heap. Nathaniel was sick with horror. He felt his knees sag. "Up with you!" The mercenary gave him a cursory shove. "Join the line." "Wait!" Nathaniel half turned. "Kitty!" "She does not share your destiny, for which you may be thankful." Nathaniel stared across at Kitty, who for a single moment caught his gaze. Then he was propelled savagely toward the crowd of prisoners. Lyme's body turned, caught sight of him. He saw green lights far off behind the eyes. A harsh voice, like the snapping of twigs, emerged from the loose mouth. "Fakwal, here is Bartimaeus's friend. You want him next?"
"Certainly I do, Gaspar. He can jump the queue. He shall come after this sour creature. Lord Nauda, I assume you have no wish to taste this one."
The great voice rumbled from on high.
"I have seen better flesh on a pharaoh's corpse. When she turns sideways, she all but disappears. Process her and be done."
Nathaniel's eyes were fixed on the figure in the pentacle. Stick-thin, white-hair dishevelled, his old master, Jessica Whitwell, stood staring up toward the throne. The demon in Withers' body had just removed her bonds. Her hands were knotted fists.
"Very well," Fakwal consulted his book. "Number 28. Let me see.
I have chosen the Afrit Mormel for you. You should be honoured. He is a noble spirit.
Ms. Whitwell stared up at the figure on the throne.
What is your plan for us?
Do not think to address the great Nauda, Farquhar cried. You and your kind have enslaved us for centuries, showing no consideration.
What do you think we plan? This revenge has been incubated for 5,000 years. No portion of the world will be safe from us.
Ms. Whitwell laughed contemptuously.
I think you are over-optimistic. Look at you all, trapped in awkward bodies, barely able to walk in a straight line.
Our inconveniences are only temporary, Farquhar said.
Yours shall be permanent. Begin the summons.
Jessica Whitwell spoke quietly.
To all the others you have given a choice. You have not asked me for mine.
Farquhar lowered his book. His eyes were narrowed.
Well, I assume, like all the other wretches, you prefer life to death, even if it is life worked through another.
You assume wrongly.
Ms. Whitwell raised her hands and made an ornate sign. She shouted out two words. A burst of yellow light, a cloud of brimstone. Her afrit, wearing the form of an uneasy-looking grizzly bear, appeared above her head. Whitwell screamed an order. A shimmering blue shield rose up around her body. The afrit sent a detonation at the startled Farquhar. It struck him head-on, knocking him off his chair halfway through the wall. The demons in the bodies of the conspirators set up a clamour. Narian raised a finger. From Jenkins' hand a lance of emerald light stabbed at Whitwell. The shield absorbed it. Whitwell was already turning, running for the exit. The demon Gaspar, encased in the body of lime, leapt forward to intercept her. Nathaniel stretched out a boot. The demon tripped, was unable to right itself, fell crashing to the ground. Nathaniel turned and ran. Above his head, the bear Afrit sent successive detonations toward the golden throne.
Where was Kitty?
There, but the mercenary held her by the arm. She struggled, kicked, could not break free. Nathaniel sped toward her. The floor shook. He stumbled, fell, and for a moment looked behind him. The body in the golden chair had moved. It was surrounded by a nimbus of pale fire. Energies crackled from its fingers. Its eyes were silver notches in the darkened face. One hand was outstretched. The power that came from it, arcing out in 5 looping bolts, one from each finger, made statues fall and mortar tumble from the ceiling. The bolts were randomly directed. 2 plunged harmlessly into the floor. 1 leapt among the crowd of newly summoned demons, destroying several human bodies. The 4th struck Whitwell's shield, broke it into shards, and cut straight through her back, killing her instantly. The bear Afrit vanished. She fell mid-stride, face down upon the flagstones. The 5th bolt burst the floor at the mercenary's feet. He was blown one way, Kitty Jones the other. Nathaniel was on his feet.
Kitty!
His voice was drowned out by assorted howls, roars, bays, and trumpetings from the demons in the hall. Confused and panic-stricken, they willed their human carriers in every direction, legs working oddly, knees too high, elbows out. They collided with each other, let fly random detonations and infernos. Among them stumbled a few magicians who had yet to be processed, arms still tied, mouths gagged, eyes wide and staring. The room was filled with smoke, lights, and rushing forms. Amid the tumult, Nathaniel came to the place where Kitty Jones had fallen. She was nowhere to be seen. He flinched as a magical pulse passed above his head and looked round a final time. No, she had gone. Without further hesitation, he ducked between 2 flailing demons and made for the double doors. As he left the Hall of Statues, he could hear Fakwal's voice rising above the commotion.
"Friends, calm down! Calm down! The crisis is over! We must resume the summonings! Calm down!"
It took Nathaniel less than a minute to negotiate the corridors and arrive at the stairs to the Whitehall vaults. Abandoning all caution, he leapt over the balustrade and careered down the staircase, 2 steps at a time. Down, down. The air grew colder. All sound from above faded clean away. Nathaniel heard nothing now but the gasping of his breath. At the end of the 3rd flight, the steps opened out into the entrance vault. 2 days before, or was it three, he had come here as information minister and had been shown the treasure room by a supercilious clerk. It seemed another life. Now the clerk's desk was empty. It gave signs of being abandoned in a hurry. Papers were scattered upon it. A pen lay on the floor. At the end of the chamber, a passage led away into the earth. A line of red tiles marked the beginning of the security zone. Nathaniel stepped toward them. As his shoe rose to cross the line, he cursed, stopped dead, and felt inside his pocket. Careful. He had almost triggered the trap. Nothing magical was permitted beyond the line. He deposited the scrying glass upon the desk, smoothed down his hair, and stepped across the tiles. If only the pestilence guarding the staff could be so easily bypassed. He hadn't a clue how to... A little noise behind him, a scraping of metal. Nathaniel stopped, looked back. Across the chamber, at the bottom of the stairs, the mercenary was standing. A curved knife glinted in his hand. Chapter 27. Kitty. Kitty shut the door. Noises from the Hall of Statues echoed in her ears. She could hear the commotion even down the corridor and through the heavy wood. She remained still for a time, pressing her ear against the door. More than anything else, she feared being followed by the terrible bearded man. Something in him filled her with more dread than the massing hordes of demons. She listened. As far as she could tell, nothing stirred in the corridor outside. A heavy key protruded beside her hand. With some difficulty, and fully conscious of the only moderate security it represented, Kitty locked the door. Then she turned to face the room. It was just as she remembered it from her failed escape attempt. Someone's office, sparsely furnished. A bookcase ran along one wall. Opposite was a desk piled high with papers. And crucially, in the near corner, scuffed and scoured with many years of bureaucratic use, two circles, two pentacles. Kitty only needed one. The pentacle design was simple, of the kind she had frequently prepared with Mr. Button. Conventional star, double circle, normal Latin hex locks. It had been painted on a raised dais, and owing to the dimensions of the room, was not particularly large. Elsewhere, she made a quick inspection, she found the usual magician's accessories, gathered in the drawers of the desk. Chalks, pens, paper, candle stubs, lighters, jars of assorted herbs. The herbs were what she needed. She extracted them with calm efficiency, and set them on the floor beside the outermost circle. From somewhere not so very distant came a loud explosion. Kitty started nervously, heart pounding in her chest. She looked toward the door. Concentrate. What did she have to do? Nathaniel's summary of the instructions in the Apocrypha had been rapid and hard to digest, but Kitty had grown used to such things during her time with Mr. Button. Her memory was suitably elastic. So, a conventional pentacle. No candles required. Yep, this one was fine. But her body should be protected, and that meant herbs and iron. She emptied out the rosemary, St. John's wort, and sticks of rowan wood, mixed them together, and separated the result into several rough piles, which she placed at intervals within the pentacle. As for the iron, that was more tricky. For a moment she cast her eyes about the room in vain. Perhaps she would have to do without it. The key. Was it iron? Kitty had no idea. If it was, it might protect her. If not, it would do no harm. She pulled it from the door. What else? Yes. Nathaniel had said something about breaking the circle, a symbolic act to allow the magician to return to his body. Very well, that could be done. She bent down, and with the key's edge, scored a gash in the painted circle. It was useless now for any ordinary summons, but this was not what Kitty planned. She stood upright. Finished. No other physical preparations were necessary, except the small matter of her comfort. On the chair behind the desk she discovered a dirty old cushion, much used and battered, and this she placed in the pentacle as a pillow. A mirror hung on the wall behind the desk. As she returned from the door, she caught sight of herself in passing. Only then did Kitty pause. It had been a while since she had looked at her face. She could not remember the last time. There she was, the thick, dark hair, dark eyes, complete with outstanding bags, the quizzical lips, a purple bruise swelling becomingly above one eye. No doubt about it, she was a little shop-worn, but still young, still well. And if she succeeded in what she planned? Terrible things had happened to those magicians who had tried to follow Ptolemy's course. Mr. Button had been unspecific in the details, but given dark hints of madness and deformity. As for Ptolemy himself, she knew he had not survived for long after creating his gate. And Bartimaeus had said his face had— With a curse, Kitty turned from the mirror. In truth, whatever risk she ran was immaterial compared with what was going on nearby. She had resolved to try, and that was an end to it. There was nothing more she could do. Getting teary would achieve nothing. So, there was nothing left for her but to lie within the pentacle. The floor was hard, but the cushion felt pleasant against the back of her head. Herb smells filled her nostrils. She took the key and closed it in her fist. A deep breath. An afterthought struck her. She raised her head, looked along her body, and to her annoyance discovered an awkward fact. She was too long for the circle. Her feet stuck out over the inner lines. Perhaps it wouldn't matter, but perhaps it would. Kitty rolled onto her side, drew her knees to her chest, and assumed a curled-up position as if she were in bed. A quick squint along? Fine. She was nice and tidy now. Nice and ready. But ready for what? A sudden burst of scepticism exploded in her. This was nothing but another of her dreams, one of the ridiculous fancies Bartimaeus had derided. It was the height of arrogance to think she could succeed when no one else had in 2,000 years or more. What was she thinking? She was no magician. But perhaps this was an advantage. Bartimaeus had prompted her to try it. She knew he had. His last words, as he left them, had echoed his description of Ptolemy. We do have a bond, but for the present there are limits to it. For the present. What was that, if not an implicit invitation to her and her alone? Ptolemy had known no limits. He had come to the other place by rejecting all the established magical conventions, by turning them on their head. And you didn't need more than the basic knowledge of summoning to do what he had done. The instructions in the Apocrypha were entirely straightforward. The crucial part was calling to the demon at the end. Kitty could do all this. The question was, would it work? There was only one way to find out. She closed her eyes and tried to relax her muscles. The room was very quiet. No sound came through the door. Time to begin the summons? No. Something was still not right. What was it? After a moment she realized her hand was clenched so tightly upon the key that it dug hard into her skin. That was a symbol of her fear. She concentrated for a few moments, allowing her finger grip to slacken. Now she cupped the metal gently. Better. Remembered fragments came into her head. Words written by past authorities about the other place. A region of chaos. A whirl of endless abominations. A sump of madness. Cheerful pronouncements all. Then there was Mr. Button's pithy edict. To venture there risks body and soul. Oh, God, so what would happen to her? Would she melt or burn? Would she see? Yes. But whatever she saw could hardly be worse or more abhorrent than Nauda and his crippled hybrids, his demons cloaked in human flesh. And none of Mr. Button's authorities had even visited the other place. It was all pure speculation. Besides, Ptolemy had returned alive. She ran through the words of the reverse summons in her head. Then, since the delay was merely to invite further fears, She spoke them out loud. As far as she could tell, it was all correct. She used her own name, rather than the demon's, and swapped the normal verbs. She finished by calling Bartimaeus's name 3 times. Done. She lay there in the quiet room. Seconds passed. Kitty quelled her mounting frustration. No good being impatient. Conventional summonings needed time for the words to travel to the other place. She listened, though for what she did not know. Her eyes were closed. She saw nothing but darkness and flickering brain echoes of light. Still nothing. Evidently the process was not going to work. Kitty's hopes passed away. She felt hollow and a little sad. She toyed with getting up, but the room was warm. She was comfortable on her pillow, and after the privations of the night was happy to rest a little. Her mind drifted on currents of its own devising. She wondered about her parents, what they were doing, how these events would touch them. How Jacob, far away in Europe, might respond. Whether Nathaniel had survived the conflagration in the hall. She found herself hoping so. A distant sound came to her ears. A clear bell ringing. The demons, perhaps, or survivors trying to alert the city. Nathaniel had saved her from the mercenary's knife. She had enjoyed sparring with him, forcing him to face the truth about many things, Bartimaeus most of all. He had taken it surprisingly well. As for Bartimaeus, she remembered how she'd last seen him, a forlorn, shapeless mass of slime, worn down by weariness of the world. Was it wrong to be pursuing him? Like anyone else, the Jinni needed rest. The bell continued to ring. It was an odd sound, now she thought about it. High and pure, as if struck on crystal, not low and booming as most bells in the city were. Also, rather than repeatedly ringing, it was a single continuous vibration that remained slightly out of reach, right on the edge of her hearing. She strained to catch it. First it faded, then grew louder. But though alluring, its character was still impossible to pin down. It was lost somewhere amid the pulsing of her blood, her quiet breathing, the little rasps of her clothing as her chest went up and down. She tried again, suddenly fascinated. The ringing seemed somewhere above her, far away. She strove to listen, wishing she could draw closer to the source. She tried to block out all other sounds. Her efforts paid off. Little by little, then with a sudden rush, the ringing clarified, became unmuffled. She was alone with it. It rang perpetually, like something precious on the verge of breaking. She felt that it was very close. Was it visible, too? Kitty opened her eyes, and saw many things at once. A complex grid of stonework all around. Little walls and floors running off in 3 dimensions, separating, joining, arching, ending. Among them were stairs, windows, and open doors. She was passing among them at speed, both very close and somehow far away. Glancing down, she saw a girl's body curled up at a distance. It reminded her of a sleeping cat. Other figures were frozen, doll-like, all about the grid of stone. Groups of men and women clustered closely, many lying prone as if asleep or dead. Around them stood strange blurry things with uncertain outlines, neither human nor completely otherwise. She could not distinguish their nature. Each one seemed almost to cancel itself out. Below it all, in some remote corridor, she saw a youth fixed in a running posture, face turned over his shoulder. Behind him was a figurine that moved, a man with a knife, legs going slowly, boots covering ground, and about them both, different shapes, remote and indistinct. Kitty felt a certain detached curiosity about all this, but her real interest lay elsewhere. The ringing sound was louder than before, somewhere very close. She concentrated still harder, and slightly to her surprise, the pretty little latticework of stones and figures distorted and twisted out of focus, as if pulled in four directions all at once. First it was quite clear, next it had blurred into a smudge. Then even the smudge had gone. Kitty felt a rushing on all sides. Not a physical sensation, for she was not aware of having an actual body, but a conceptual one. Dimly she glimpsed four barriers all around her. They towered above, plummeted below, stretched to infinity on either side. One was dark and solid and threatened to crush her with remorseless weight. The next was a raging fluid, which surged avidly to carry her away. The third barrier tore at her with the unseen tumult of a hurricane. The fourth was an implacable wall of unquenchable fire. All four beat upon her for an instant only. Then they recoiled. With reluctance, they gave her up, and Kitty passed through the gate to the other side. Chapter 28 Kitty. It was as well for Kitty that she experienced what followed with the detachment of an observer, rather than as a helpless participant. If it had been otherwise, she would immediately have gone mad. As it was, the lack of bodily sensation gave what she saw a certain dreamlike quality. Curiosity was her main emotion. She found herself in, well, in, did not seem quite appropriate. She found herself part of a ceaseless swirl of movement, neither ending nor beginning, in which nothing was fixed or static. It was an infinite ocean of lights, colours, and textures, perpetually forming, racing, and dissolving in upon themselves. Though the effect was neither as thick or solid as a liquid, nor as traceless as a gas. If anything, it was a combination of the two, in which fleeting wisps of substance endlessly parted and converged. Scale and direction were impossible to determine, as was the passing of time, since nothing remained still and no patterns were ever repeated. The concept itself seemed blank and meaningless. This mattered little to Kitty, and it was only when she attempted to locate herself, with a view to establishing her position in her surroundings, that she grew a little disconcerted. She had no fixed point, no singularity to call her own. Indeed, she seemed often to be in several places at once, watching the whirling traces from multiple angles. The effect was most disorientating. She tried to fix upon a particular fleck of colour and follow it, but found it no easier than following the motion of a single leaf in a distant wind-blown tree. As soon as it formed, each colour split, melted, merged with others, shrugged off the responsibility of being itself. Kitty grew dizzy with the looking. To make matters worse, she began to notice something else, too, flicking in and out of existence within the general swirl. Random images, so fleeting she could not pin them down, like photographs turned on and off by crackling electric light. She tried to work out what they were, but the movement was too fast. This filled her with frustration. She sensed they might have told her something. After an unknown duration, Kitty remembered that she had come here for a purpose, although what that purpose was she could not recall. She had no inclination to do anything particularly. Her main impulse was to remain exactly as she was, moving among the rushing lights. Nevertheless, something about the ceaseless change irritated her and kept her separate from it. She wanted to impose a little order, some solidity. But how could she do this when she lacked solidity herself? Half-heartedly she willed herself to move toward a particular patch of orange and maroon, swirling at an unknown distance. To her surprise, she moved all right, but in several discordant directions. When her vision stabilized, the patch of colour was no closer than before. She tried several times with the same result. Her movements were veering and haphazard. It was impossible to predict the outcome. For the first time, Kitty felt a faint anxiety. She noted several patches of boiling darkness curling and uncurling among the lights. They stirred echoes of old, earthbound fears, of nothingness and solitude, of being alone amid infinity.
"This is no good," Kitty thought. "I need a body."
With mounting disquiet, she watched the remorseless movement flowing all around, the images flickering near and far, the crackles of light and senseless trails of colour. One merry, dancing, blue-green coil caught her attention.
"Stand still," she thought furiously.
Was it her imagination, or had a little portion of the flowing coil deviated from its course, slowing for an instant? The motion was so quick she could not be sure. Kitty spied another random wisp and willed it to halt and attend to her. The results were immediate and satisfactory. A sizable tendril of matter solidified into something resembling the rolled tip of a fern frond, colourless and glassy. When she relaxed her attention, the coil unfurled and vanished back into the general swirl. Kitty tried again, this time willing a patch of matter to form a thicker, more compact object. Once more she had success, and by concentrating further was able to mould the glassy lump into something approaching a block, unevenly squared. Again, when she desisted, the block dissolved to nothing. The malleability of the substance all around reminded Kitty of something she had seen before. What was it? With difficulty her mind grasped at a memory. That of the jinni Bartimaeus changing form. He needed to occupy a shape of some kind when he came to Earth, though his choices were always fluid. Perhaps, now that the positions were reversed, she should try the same. She could make herself a shape. And with this inspiration, the object of her visit came back to her. Yes, it was Bartimaeus she had come to find. Kitty's anxiety faded. She was enthused. She set to work straight away, building herself a body. Unfortunately, this was easier thought than done. She had no difficulty by applying her will once more in forming a patch of the flowing energies into something approximating a human shape. It had a bulbous head of sorts, a stumpy torso, and four uneven limbs, all dully see-through, so that the rushing colours and lights behind were distorted on its surfaces. But when Kitty tried to improve this rough marionette into something more refined and accurate, she discovered she was unable to concentrate on it all at once. While she shaped and evened out the legs, the head slumped like melted butter. When she hastened to repair this and add a token face, the bottom half dripped and sagged. So it went, until her series of rushed improvements had entirely ruined the figurine, and it had stabilized as a pin-headed blob with enormous buttocks. Kitty regarded it with dissatisfaction. It also proved overly complex to maneuver. Although she was able to direct it back and forth, it floated among the raging energies like a bird amid a storm, Kitty found she could not individually direct its limbs. While she struggled to do so, the body's substance dribbled away from its extremities, like thread unravelling from a spindle. After a time, Kitty gave up in disgust, and allowed the figure to dissolve into nothing. Despite this setback, she felt pleased with her idea in principle, and immediately began work again. In quick succession, she tried a variety of other surrogate bodies, testing each for ease of control. The first, a stick figure, rather like a child's drawing, contained less substance than its predecessor. Kitty was also able to prevent it from unravelling, but found the savage energies all around made it crumple like a crane fly. The second, a snaking sausage with a questing tendril at its front, was more stable, but aesthetically unsound. The third, a simple ball of swirling matter, was far stronger and easier to maintain, and with it she progressed a considerable distance, floating serenely through the chaos.
"Lack of limbs is the key," Kitty thought. "A sphere is good. It imposes order."
The shape certainly had some effect on her surroundings, since it was not long before Kitty began to notice a slight change in the fabric through which her ball was passing. Up until then, the coils of colour, The shimmering lights, the intermittent images, had all been entirely neutral and unresponsive, flowing randomly where they would. But now, perhaps because of the new decisiveness with which she maintained the sphere, they seemed to become aware of her presence. She sensed it in the movement of the swirls, which suddenly became more definite, intentional. They began to change direction slightly, darting in close to the ball, then veering away as if in doubt. Time and again this happened, with the coils and flickers growing steadily in strength and number. They seemed merely inquisitive, but it was an ominous kind of attention, like sharks gathering about a swimmer, and Kitty didn't like it. She slowed the progress of her ball, and with a careful exertion of will, she was now gaining in confidence, imposed herself upon the whirling substance. Taking the static sphere as her centre, she drove outward, pushing back the nearest intrepid coils, which dissolved and scattered. The remission this provided was short-lived. Just as Kitty was congratulating herself on her strength of purpose, a sudden glassy coil extended out from the main mass, like an amoeba's pseudopodium, and bit into the edge of her sphere, carrying off a chunk. As she strove to make good the damage, another coil darted in from the opposite side and took another slice. Furiously, she beat the coils back. The main mass all about her pulsed and quivered. Lights flickered intently in random clusters. For the first time, Kitty felt true fear. "Bartimaeus," she thought, "where are you?" The word seemed to conjure a reaction in the substance. A sudden burst of static images fired and faded, stronger and more lingering than before. One or two lasted long enough for her to catch details, figures, faces, random snatches of sky, once a definite building, a roof with columns. The figures were human, but wore unfamiliar styles of clothes. The fleeting pictures reminded Kitty of past occasions when long-forgotten memories rose unbidden into her mind. But these were not her memories. As if in response to this thought, a sudden burst of activity far out in the whirling confusion ended with an image that did linger. It was fractured, as if seen through the lens of a broken camera, but what it showed was clear enough. Her parents, standing together hand in hand. As Kitty watched, her mother raised a distorted hand and waved.
"Kitty, come back to us."
"Go away." Kitty reacted with confusion and dismay. It was a trick, obviously it was, but that didn't make it any less upsetting. Her concentration wavered. Her hold over her sphere and her single area of cleared order lurched and trembled. The sphere slumped and sagged. Coils of matter came creeping in from every side.
"Kitty, we love you.
Get lost." She drove the coils back again. The image of her mum and dad winked out. With grim determination, Kitty returned her sphere to its proper shape. She was increasingly dependent on it for any semblance of control, for any semblance of being herself. More than anything, she feared being adrift again without it. Other pictures flashed on and off, each one different, most too fast to fathom. Some, though barely perceptible, must have been familiar to her. They awoke inarticulate feelings of agitation and loss. A flurry of lights. Another picture, very far away. An old man leaning on a stick. Behind his back was a rushing slab of blackness.
"Kitty, help! It's coming!
Mr. Pennyfeather!
Don't leave me!"
The figure looked over its shoulder, cried out in terror. The vision was gone. Almost immediately another appeared, a woman running between columns with something dark and agile skittering in pursuit, a flash of white among shadows. Kitty concentrated her energies on the sphere. Ignore them. They were nothing but phantasms, blank and empty. They meant nothing.
"Bartimaeus!"
Again she sought the name, beseechingly this time. Again it awoke activity among the floating lights and drifting spurs of colour. Close up, with crystal clarity, came Jacob Hernick, smiling sadly.
"You always did try to be too independent, Kitty," Why not just give up? Come and join us here. It's best not to go back to Earth. You won't like it if you do.
Why?
She couldn't help but ask the question. Poor child. You'll see. You are not as you were. Another image appeared alongside, a tall man with dark skin standing on a grassy hill. His face was grave. Why do you come here and molest us? A woman wearing a high white headdress, gathering water at a well. You were a fool to come here. You are not welcome.
I come for help.
You will not get it. The woman's image scowled and vanished. The man with dark skin turned to walk away up his hill. Why do you molest us? He asked again over his shoulder. You wound us with your presence. A flicker of lights. He too was gone. Jacob Hernick gave a rueful smile.
Give up, magician. Forget yourself. You cannot get home in any case. I am not a magician.
True. You are nothing now. A dozen coils enveloped him. He crackled and fizzed into a multitude of whirling shards that floated far away.
Nothing.
Kitty regarded her ball, which during her recent inattention had melted away like snow. Little flakes were fluttering off what remained of its surface. As if blown by a wind, they skipped and danced across to join the endless whirl about her. Well, it was true, of course. She was nothing. A being without substance, without anchorage. There wasn't any point in pretending otherwise. And they were right about another thing, too. She didn't know how to get home. Her will faded. She allowed the sphere to dwindle. It spun like a top, streaming into nothing. She began to drift. Another image flickered into view, at an indeterminate distance. Hello, Kitty.
Get lost.
And there I was, thinking you were asking after me. Chapter 29 Nathaniel. For almost 30 seconds, Nathaniel and the mercenary regarded each other silently across the chamber floor. Neither of them moved. The knife in the mercenary's hand was still. His empty hand hovered close beside his belt. Nathaniel watched intently, but without hope. He had seen how fast those hands could move, and he was quite defenseless. At their other meetings he had had Bartimaeus on his side. The mercenary spoke first. "I have come to take you back," he said. "The demon wishes to have you alive." Nathaniel said nothing. He didn't move. He was trying to think of a strategy, but his brain was stiff with fear. Every thought moved with the creaking sluggishness of ice. "I believe several of the prospective hosts have been killed," the mercenary went on. "Nauder is keen to save as many young bodies as he can." "Well, or would you prefer a more honourable death? I can oblige."
"We don't."
Nathaniel's voice was thick. His tongue felt too large for his mouth. "We don't have to fight at all." A rumbling laugh. "Fight? That implies some parity between us."
"I have one slave left at my command,"
Nathaniel lied.
"Think quickly before he strikes. We can still work together against the enemy. It is in your interests, too. You must see that. I will pay you well from the nation's treasury. I shall give you gold uncounted. I can make you a lord, give you lands, territories, whatever your black heart desires. Only you must fight alongside me. Here, in these vaults, are weapons we can use."
For answer, the mercenary spat upon the chamber floor. "I want no lands or titles. My sect forbids such fripperies. Gold, yes, but that the demons will give me if I serve them. And do not speak, I know your argument. So what if Nauder destroys all London? Or all Europe, for that matter? He can burn the world, for all I care. I have no faith in empires, ministers, or kings. Let chaos come. I shall flourish. So, what is your answer? Will you die here?